you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, friends and neighbors, and welcome. Welcome to this week's roundtable, where we look back at the big news of the week and try to make some sense of it all. And boy, what a busy week it's been. With a big Thursday vote in the House, the impeachment inquiry is now officially underway, and public hearings will begin soon. Meanwhile, several top administration officials, including one who was on that fateful call between Donald Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine, have testified that there was, in fact, a quid pro quo, all orchestrated by Rudy Giuliani. In Syria, the head of ISIS was run down by U.S. Delta forces, thanks to intelligence provided to us by the Kurds, in return for which Donald Trump threw them under the bus. And Twitter says it will not accept any political ads in 2020, while Facebook says, we'll run anything you want, outright lies or all. So here to untangle it all with us today, Pema Levy, political reporter for Mother Jones. Hi, Pema.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Dr. Julianne Malveaux, economist and columnist for Black Press USA, joining us for the first roundtable. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Good to see you. And Brad Woodhouse, former communications director for the DNC and now the executive director of Protect Our Care, making sure that Obamacare is still available for millions of Americans. Hello, Brad.
Good morning, Bill.
All right. Good to see you guys. So for the fourth week in a row, the big story is the impeachment inquiry. And the big story about that, I guess, the breaking news today is that we learned that John Bolton will testify if he gets a subpoena to testify. Pema, is this going to be the one, John Bolton, that brings the Republicans on board?
I doubt it, but you never know.
But
John,
it's a big deal, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's basically saying that, you know, the executive privilege claims are not going to stand up against a subpoena, so go ahead and send me a subpoena here. He clearly didn't leave the administration on the best of terms. And I think what we know from the people who have testified, a lot of people who worked under him, have said that he basically saw what Rudy Giuliani was doing was dangerous, was, you know, his own shadow foreign policy. I think he referred to it as a drug deal and that he wanted no part of. When you get shunted from the Trump administration, you're sort of on your own, right? You know, Trump doesn't really command that loyalty for a lot of people once he's, you know, sort of sends them packing unceremoniously. And that's what happened to Bolton. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see what he's willing to say.
So, Julianne, I thought one of the most interesting developments this week was that the president himself said to Republicans, stop talking about process. Let's talk about substance. I want you to talk about substance. Really?
I found that very amusing because actually all the Republicans have fought about was process. Is it fair? Do we get enough witnesses? That's been their thing. If they drill down into substance, we have any number of things to look at. Mick Mulvaney's own admission. Oh, sure, everybody does quid pro quo. The ambassadors who've testified. And there have been, see, Republicans are playing a very dangerous game, because they're behaving as if they're victims. They're not in the room. But there are, you know, what is it, a third of the members of any of these committees are Republican. The majority has most members, but they're in the room. They're in the deliberations. So that little stunt they pulled, busting into a meeting, was just a stunt. And by talking about process, they're making themselves look like fools, except for the one-third of the population who loves fools.
We got it. So, Brad, the vote yesterday in the House to proceed and to lay out the rules by which the inquiry will go forward, 232 to 196, as we know, it was basically a partisan vote. Two Democrats broke and one independent, yep. Julian, otherwise partisan vote. But that does mean there are going to be public hearings. This thing is like a train.
It's definitely right? A train moving down the tracks. And I think the thing about Bolton eventually testifying in the deposition and then maybe eventually in public hearings is that he would be the star witness. Now there's a lot of possible risk and reward there because he is still a very firmly planted in the Republican establishment. He's not somebody that I think wants to help Democrats, but he does seem to be offended by what took place. By the way, I think he's also offended by, and I thought it was a weird match for him to be National Security Advisor, offended by Donald Trump's, the rest of his foreign policy, including his approach to Syria, his approach to North Korea. I mean, this is so anti-John Bolton. But John Bolton has spent a decade and a half or more on television. He's done a lot of it on Fox. I think he has the potential, if he is going to testify to what we've heard and what was in the transcript that we now know wasn't complete, I think he stands to be the star witness in the public hearings.
Yeah. So, Pema, in terms of back to substance process, looking at substance, we now have, as Julianne pointed out, I forget all of them, but William Taylor, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, apparently yesterday Mr. Sullivan, I guess, or Morrison. All of whom have said, and Sondland even, that there was a quid pro quo. They were withholding military aid in return for an investigation into Joe Biden and maybe a White House visit, right? Okay, so... is that substance? Can Republicans stand and defend that substance? And do you start to see any cracks, particularly among Republican senators, saying we can't defend this?
Yeah, I mean, I think back to what Julianne said. I'm like the one defender here a little bit of Mick Mulvaney here. Not that I think that he was being particularly clever, or he clearly sort of fumbled. But I think that he kind of had the Trump line right, which is to go out and say, yeah, we did it. We'll do it in the open and get over it. It's not a big deal, right? Instead of trying to say we didn't do something we clearly did,
right.
You just
right.
normalize it and then move on.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, he didn't do a good job of it. It didn't go over well. But I think on some level, if Republicans are going to stick with Trump, they're going to have to adopt that line. They're going yep. to have to figure out a way to say, you can, as the president, use your foreign policy powers to coerce other governments to help you politically, even if it goes against our foreign policy and our national security, and be okay with that. And I don't know how they do that exactly. And obviously, that's why they want to talk about the process, right? That's obviously where they're the strongest, even though they've sort of made up these complaints that aren't grounded in anything real. But at some point, you know, especially, you know, I think Trump basically is like, talk about substance, pretend that nothing bad happened. right. And well, so, you know, that's hard.
Perfect call, right?
Well, I mean, this is exactly the direction this is going. I mean, and you've already heard some senators say this, well, maybe he did it. It's not an impeachable offense. And then others are saying that what Pema just said is, yes, he did it. And there's nothing wrong with it. And I think you're going to see four or five different iterations of he did it, but it's not impeachable. He did it and it doesn't matter. It's not wrong. And what they want is whatever will latch on with the base, and they want chaos. The more that this is chaos and there's and Democrats are having to chase, well, it is impeachable. I mean, we shouldn't even go there as Democrats. We should just assert that it's impeachable, not try to refute Republicans saying it isn't, just lay out the facts and move on. But they want chaos out of this. They're going to be a lot of different defense theories as we go forward.
Yeah, so, Julia. You know, it seems to me when we look at some of this that there will be some senators. Mitt Romney, I think, is likely to at least be more open than some of the others. I mean, the difference between the House members, there was a piece in the Post today about a guy, and I've forgotten his name, who said...
Francis Rooney.
Right. He said that he wants to look at the charges, and they've run him out of office already. He said, I won't run again, just because they demand full solidarity.
It's close to home. My wife is his chief of staff.
So. Oh, wow. Okay. But, you know, they're elected every two years.
Right.
Senators are elected every 6 years. So I do see the possibility that Romney and a handful of others, not many, but a handful of others might raise these questions. I also, yesterday I saw someone who said, well, you know, we impeached Clinton, but we didn't convict him because it wasn't worth running a president out of office for a sexual affair. So I imagine, to your point, that they'll sort of say, well, you know, he was wrong, but it wasn't impeachable. That's the best argument that they can make.
Well, I was going to say that to me, this is so deja vu all over again. I mean, I was doing.
Bill, deja vu is always all over again.
I know. Thank you, Yogi Berra. I was doing Crossfire at the time when the Monica Lewinsky story broke, and night one, my take was, what Bill Clinton did, was wrong, but it was not an impeachable offense, and I think that was true in 1998, but I find it hard to make that argument when you're talking about foreign policy, national security, withholding military aid in return for political dirt. There is a difference, or am I?
Well, there is a difference. I mean, the whole thing, just like Katie Hill, which I know we're going to talk about later, but personal peccadilloes, as far as I'm concerned, whether they're personal stuff, should not drum you out of office. You shouldn't have sex with your intern, of course, but that should not draw you out of office. But these things, you're basically putting our nation and other nations in jeopardy by saying you're going to withhold foreign aid that Congress already voted for. So
Congress said it was in our national security interest.
Yes.
So this almost, in addition to everything else, it's almost contempt of Congress.
Yep.
You know, it reminds me of Nixon with the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Act, when he impounded, this was way back, 74, 75, but he impounded money that Congress had apportioned because he didn't want to spend it.
Right. And Pema, it looks like that if there are articles of impeachment, which it seems that there will be, one of them will be contempt of Congress or obstruction of justice, right?
Of course. I think it'll go on for pages just on that topic. I think, you know, a lot of people sort of say that, oh, well, if someone so-and-so won't testify, that's fine. We'll just wrap it into an article of impeachment and move on. And, you know, I think that's their best option on some level, but I think it's really dissatisfying. Mm-hmm. If Congress actually had the power to compel that testimony, that would be a lot more powerful. And so it's a weak substitute for what they're not able to get.
Now, one very helpful addition to the debate over the impeachment inquiry, this a voice we haven't heard from in a little bit, Donald Trump Jr. spoke out yesterday. Remember, the request was for the Ukraine to investigate the business dealings of the former vice president and his son, Hunter. And poor Donald Trump Jr. says, if only I were Hunter Biden, here he is.
I wish my name was Hunter Biden. I could go abroad, make millions off of my father's presidency. I'd be a really rich guy. It would be incredible. But because my name is Trump, if I took $1.5 from China, not $1.5 billion like Hunter, but $1.5, their heads would explode.
My head is exploding.
Our heads are collectively exploding. I mean, this is what you call total hubris. I mean, these folks travel all over the world with our tax dollars protecting them. Going here and opening a hotel, going there and opening a hotel, with our Secret Service and other stuff protecting them. Ivanka walks away with how many Chinese patents, whatever, which she wouldn't have if she were not the president's daughter. So, I mean, he's telling on himself. I mean, these people, you know, the only thing I can say about him is they're stupid enough to tell on themselves.
Yeah. I have to say, I think on some level, you know, he's really staying on message here. And on some level, it shows the way in which the rest of Washington has kind of moved on. You know, we're not really talking about Joe Biden's misdeeds anymore. We're not talking about Hunter Biden making some pretty dubious choices here. We're talking about the president's misdeeds. And, you know, Don Jr. over here is on TV staying on message saying, it's about the Bidens, everyone. It's still about the Bidens. But look, you know, to the credit of Democrats and what they've been able to do over the last couple of weeks, I think the country has moved on from that. So, you know, it's clearly hypocritical. But it's also feels, you know, already sort of, you know, an old complaint that we've all moved on from.
Boy, it just really shows that they have no shame at all, right?
Well,
None whatsoever.
They have no shame, but it also shows we live in two completely different worlds. The people watching that program would buy his argument, and they, you know, they believe that the Trumps are righteous and above board and moral. And I mean, it's stunning. But I mean, we live in two different worlds when it comes to
they
that.
They don't believe they're moral. They believe they're getting what they want.
Well,
I mean,
that's right.
They really don't believe they're moral. They
don't care. Right.
They love the fact that 45 has put his nose, his finger in everybody's face.
Yep.
They love that. The, you know, last gasp of white supremacy loves the way that he plays with race.
Yep.
They don't think they're more. There may be some little old lady in the backwoods of Florida who thinks they're moral, yeah. But most people are very, very clear about this. They're getting what they want. Right.
Florida, we should mention, we don't have to spend any time on it, that the newest residents of Florida are Donald and Melania Trump, who have changed their residence officially.
So they don't have to pay taxes.
From New York to Florida, to which Governor Andrew Cuomo said, goodbye, good riddance. It's Florida, he's all yours. Which I thought was a great response. It has been less than a week since one of the most evil men on the planet, al-Baghdadi, was tracked down by our U.S. Delta Forces, thanks to intelligence we got from the Kurds, a spy inside of Baghdadi's inner circle who gave this information to the Kurds, who passed it on to us, and he was tracked down, and then he killed himself, we know, last Sunday. Here we are, a meeting Friday morning, about 8:30, November 1st in Washington, and nobody's talking about this anymore. I mean, when bin Laden was killed, it went on for weeks. Nobody's talking about it. And then Donald Trump did talk about it last Sunday night, describing what happened.
He died after running into a dead-end tunnel, whimpering and crying and screaming all the way.
Which nobody else has confirmed that that's what happened, but Donald Trump kind of was on the
was
scene.
Was he actually there? You know, the thing that struck me about his statement last Sunday was that it was so unstatesmanlike. I mean, not that he ever has been, but I mean, you know, the
you
man
weren't expecting anything different. Right?
Well, I didn't expect him to be so harsh and so, you know, damn. Yeah. I mean, the man did die. I mean, he was one of the most evil people in the world. But kids died with him.
And his kids.
His kids, right.
Yeah, but 45, he was whimpering like a dog. I mean, I just think that's so unstatesmanlike and so unnecessary.
I would grant you that point. I think it was. My question, Pamela, what did Trump sort of, like, step all over his own message in this?
I think so. You know, I think, as we've been talking about, I'm sure there's a segment that enjoyed the statement being made like in that way. But I think to everyone else, it's so jarring that you immediately sort of go to the way in which Trump presented it rather than the news itself. I don't think this has totally disappeared. And, you know, I think on some level people are giving him credit for this. This is a win, if you want to talk about it in those terms. But yeah, he kind of like obscured the whole win immediately with the way that he did it. And then there's so much else going on. You know, when you have it works both ways, right? So if you have a chaos presidency where there's just a million things going on and there's constant distractions, then on the one hand, you benefit because when something bad happens, people move on. It also hurts you when something, you know, quote unquote, good happens for you, people move on. We're in the middle of impeachment. We've got a lot going on. He sort of gives an almost deranged sounding statement about this and, and we move on like we do with everything else.
And the one aspect of it, Brad, is we did again, I keep coming back to this. We were able to get this guy thanks to the Kurds.
Well, right.
Right.
Right. And,
a couple of days after
the same Kurds we threw under the bus.
We abandoned the Kurds and said, you know, out of your territory, too bad. And you didn't help us at all.
And I'll give credit to the media, the New York Times and others who I don't think always cover this president in the right way or certainly don't cover the campaigns in the right way. I mean they called it out that we killed Baghdadi in spite of Trump's policy, in spite of what he had done to the Kurds and throwing the Kurds under the bus and pulling out of Syria. And so I think that is another reason that he's not getting the credit that he probably wants. I think another reason is very few Americans knew who Baghdadi was and everyone knew who bin Laden was.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just to piggyback there, I mean, we're also talking about, you know, the one time he wants to praise the intelligence community that every other day he says is a deep state coup. And, you know, there's a lot of mixed messages coming with this one. I think it's, you know, people don't know exactly what to make of everything.
Right. In the midst of the impeachment vote in the House yesterday, there was a very poignant farewell given by a California Democrat just elected to the House, Katie Hill, who was caught in what Washington loves best, I guess, a good old-fashioned sex scandal here on the floor. Katie Hill making a point, I'm going, but this does raise some questions.
I'm leaving because there is only one investigation that deserves the attention of this country, and that's the one that we voted on today. Today, I ask you all to stand with me and commit to creating a future where this no longer happens to women and girls. I'm leaving, but we have men who have been credibly accused of intentional acts of sexual violence and remain in boardrooms, on the Supreme Court, in this very body, and worst of all, in the Oval Office. We have an entire culture that has to change, and we see it in stark clarity today. The forces of revenge by a bitter, jealous man, cyber exploitation and sexual shaming that target our gender and a large segment of society that fears and hates powerful women have combined to push a young woman out of power and say that she doesn't belong here. Yet a man who brags about his sexual predation, who's had dozens of women come forward to accuse him of sexual assault, who pushes policies that are uniquely harmful to women, and who has filled the courts with judges who proudly rule to deprive women of the most fundamental right to control their own bodies, sits in the highest office of the land.
Wow.
Wow.
So, is she on point? Is there a double standard for men and for women and for Republicans and for Democrats?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I listened to her, my heart really broke for her. I mean, she's a progressive young Democrat who was doing a good job now, and she didn't know that these pictures were taken. So these pictures were apparently taken without her consent. So what one does in their own bedroom is their own business. She was openly bisexual. She never hid from that. And so she says she's got, I hope she sues that man. I hope so. I hope that he never has a clear glass of water without having to pay her for it. I mean, he basically ruined her career because he was evil, mean, and jealous. But she's also right about the double and triple standards. It's very ironic that the first person who gets investigated for having a relationship with a staff member is a woman. How many men have done this? I mean, it's just very ironic. And basically, the whole notion of sex shaming and slut shaming is alive and well. And men have to really stand up for this and say, no, enough, enough, enough. Like I said, my heart breaks for her. It really does.
I kept thinking of Al Franken.
Yeah. I mean, there's some similarities here. I mean, obviously, the ex-husband here is the big difference. But this is a story that was planted in right-wing media. It's a story that was inflamed. That was inflamed on the right. And, you know, and Democrats, I think, Democrats in Franken's case, obviously, forced him out. No one here, I think, on the Democratic side came to Katie Hill's defense. No one said, let's have an ethics investigation. No one tried to talk her out of resigning. I'll tell you, if you listen to that clip and you listen to her speech on the floor, there's a second act there. It may not be for Al Franken simply because of how much older he is, but at her age, there's definitely absolutely a second act.
Al Franken's back with a podcast.
Yes, he is.
So, but Pema, you know, again, Al Franken, David Vitter was soliciting prostitutes, making phone calls on the floor of the Senate. And the Republicans said, well, that's all right, let the voters decide, right?
Yeah, there's sort of this sort of, one-sided disarmament going on here, I think, yeah. Right? I mean, you have the Democratic Party says, you know, we want to hold ourselves to a high standard, and the Republicans say, cool, go ahead.
We're not. We'll hold ourselves to a low standard.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, David Vitter is one. You've got Scott DeJarle, who's still in the House after his crazy affair abortion scandal. And then obviously there's Trump, right? There's Kavanaugh. There's, you know, people who have been credibly accused, and then they throw a fit.
In the Alabama Senate
right.
Race.
And so I think that there's a frustration there. And, you know, on some level with Katie Hill, it's still an evolving story, right? She's resigning, but I think there's still some questions. But I think that there's the idea of, like, well, we're Democrats. We're going to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And then at the same time, you have these promising politicians who are then shown the door.
Right. So much to talk about. That's why we got the roundtable together today. A quick break, and we'll be right back. And today's podcast, today's roundtable, brought to you by the Iron Workers Union, those good men and women of the iron workers under President Eric Dean. They are building America's communities today, and they're ready to rebuild America's infrastructure tomorrow. if the Congress ever gets its stuff together, which they've been talking about for a long time but doing nothing about. At any rate, in the meantime, we salute the iron workers, thank them for the support of the podcast, direct you to their website, which is simply ironworkers.org.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And welcome back. We're back with today's roundtable and our panelists, Pema Levy and Julian Malveaux and Brad Woodhouse. Politics, politics, politics. Before we get to 2020, there's been a lot of talk about the social media and their impact on the races, which was quickened this week when Facebook announced, yes, we're going to run political ads, but we're not going to censor them. It's up to the candidates. They can say basically whatever they want. Mark Zuckerberg defending that as freedom of speech. Twitter responded this week by saying, we're not going to run any political ads at all, just to stay out of this mess. Brad, who wins this one?
Well, look, I don't think there's a solution to this beyond some type of regulatory framework. I mean, I don't know if Congress can ever figure that out. I'm not saying that Congress or the federal government is the solution to this, but we do have rules for network advertising, for access to candidates, for lowish unit rate. I mean, so there is some experience in government and in Congress in regulating political ads. I don't think that either Twitter's approach and certainly Zuckerberg's approach, I don't think either one is the solution. The Twitter thing is interesting because they have virtually no revenue from political advertising. I mean, it's great. It sends a signal, but it's a decision that has virtually no consequences to their bottom line.
Pema, does this really matter?
Twitter's decision? Does it matter?
Either one. I mean, does it really have any impact in the real world?
I'm of the opinion that it does. I've actually spent a long time thinking about this move by Facebook and talking to civil rights advocates about this. And I know that, civil rights groups have been working with Facebook, mostly frustratingly, for years to try to get them to take the content on their platform seriously, to try to, take hate speech seriously, voter suppression seriously, what we call racial appeals. Right, sort of like triggering people's inner racism and sort of, send. So you know, when you say people can lie, and it's not just in ads, it's also just in their posts.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
For politicians. And you look at the fact that, you know, how many politicians are in this country? Well, it turns out that there are about 500,000 people in elected office in this country. You from your water board, you know, to your county sheriff, to your county judge, to the president. And then you've got people running against them. And then you've got primaries. So, I mean, I don't know. You could have 2 million people that now can basically say they can post and run whatever they want. If it's, you know, hate speech, if it's a racial appeal, if it's, you know, Ilhan Omar is a terrorist, or all sorts of things that put people in danger, that spread misinformation, that Facebook has gone around basically since 2016 saying, we're really sorry, we're going to crack down on this stuff. Mm-hmm. And now they've just basically said, here, a million people, do whatever you want.
Hmm. Yeah,
you know, and then we'll clean up the mess later. And I think that, you know, that's really dangerous when you're talking about, you know, an ecosystem where fake news and memes and you know, racial dog whistles take off.
Mm-hmm. You know, I found Facebook laughable for any number of reasons. I mean, a bunch of us who are black nationalists have been, I was put in Facebook jail, I think, 3 times. That when they put you in jail, you can't post anymore. You know, because I described an incident that occurred. I said, this white boy. So they said, this is hate speech. I mean, it's a description. Right. So they put me in Facebook jail. So while they are, you know, basically screening my description, and I put the guy's picture up there, that was kind of mean, but whatever, they will put any kind of lie on there. We know that the Russians and others used Facebook to target the African-American community and to suppress the vote. So, okay. I mean, I think that they're laughable. At the same time, I'm not sure about Twitter. As you say, they don't get that much money from political ads, so, but they're making they're taking a stand and making a statement. Mm-hmm. Facebook, these ads need to be filtered, just like they filter everything else. And they're not trying to do that because they make too much money. And I mean, Zuckerberg's performance in Congress was laughable. It was utterly laughable. And I think, you know, members of Congress are still trying to figure out what to do. But I'm not sure, Brad, that there's so much of an anti-regulatory consciousness that I'm not sure how you regulate something like that. But there has to be something.
And that's a question that a lot of people in Congress are struggling with. So on the 2020 front, there were two polls out this week. One showed Joe Biden, national polls, up 15 points, and the other showed Elizabeth Warren, I forget which was which, up 7 points. What's going on? And has this boiled down to a race between Biden and Elizabeth Warren? Or Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg still in the picture? Or anybody else?
Well, you know, first of all, the whole issue of sample size, and who is your sample? So you can lie with statistics. I mean, I taught a course about that once called You Can Lie with Statistics. You can go find what you want. And, you know, some of these are frequent voters. Some of these are the total universe. Right. Some of these are just Iowans. And so I think when you look at these, what we know is that it's Warren, Biden, probably Sanders, maybe Buttigieg, maybe Kamala hanging there. Sort of, a sister has to have hope. but in any case, we know there's a top five, and maybe there's a top three inside the top five. And I think these polls are pretty much meaningless. I think the Iowa is going to be the story.
Look, I think we need to see more credible polls in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada. The national polls we know don't matter. This is not a national race. I think that you're going to see in November and December, I think is key. Who makes the debate stage? It looks like most of the top candidates and some of the candidates that probably don't have a shot are going to make the debate stage for November. Fewer will make it for December. But I think as you get closer to the vote in Iowa, more people are going to be tuning in, and I think these debates take on higher importance. And so I think a debate where someone really soars has the potential. You know, if you get a bounce this late, you may be able to sustain it. We saw bounces in early on in some of these debates that weren't sustained. Yeah. So I think these debates are really, really key. I think someone that is below the Warren, Sanders, Biden level could pop up. Buttigieg seems to be the most likely. I think Harris is still very much in this in that regard. And so I think the debates are really key.
But the momentum does seem to be with Elizabeth Warren, doesn't it, Emma? Do you agree?
I do agree with that. I think that there is also some momentum with Buttigieg, especially in Iowa. And I do sort of agree that, you know, you have like this mismatch where you have these national polls But then you have, you know, you have Iowa and New Hampshire. And I think, you know, the Biden folks are basically like, well, yeah, we're not going to win either of those, but we'll come in strong in South Carolina.
Yeah, and in fact,
but these things build on each other, right? It's hard to sort of come off of two losses and then sort of build and then win and then sort of, you know, change that narrative that way. So I think that there's a lot of questions about whether or not you can have basically no momentum for the next 5 months and then win.
Certainly Biden is setting the expectations right for Iowa and New Hampshire. And yeah. So, you know, it's possible that a pretty decent second place win in one of those will, you know, I don't think he'll be out of the race losing both unless he falls, I think, below second place in both will be tough.
Well, right. South Carolina is going to be really telling for Biden especially.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, he has really worked.
It'll be make or break.
He's really worked the African-American community there. And, you know, a lot of the baby boom generation favors him over the others. You know, Kamala and Cory Booker have not been able to make the inroads that many of us thought they would in South Carolina. So if he comes in second or third in South Carolina, it's like, okay, pack your bags.
Well, one thing I'll say about Biden is he's had some staying power. We've seen a lot of examples over the years where people who came in as the front runners in the spring were decidedly not in the top of the pack later on. They could not sustain that, and he is still at the top of the pack.
All right, just one quick point. Looking around the table, does anybody here see anybody else jumping in, or is it too late?
No.
Okay.
No. My Republican friends keep saying Hillary Clinton's going to get in. I'm like, she's not going to get. She's not going to get in.
Or Bloomberg or
I don't think so.
Sherrod Brown or no.
No. It's too late. I think this is it.
This is it. Okay.
And it's plenty.
Now then there is. We've put the best off to last. Now there is the biggest and the most important story of the entire week. It happened Wednesday night.
Here they are, one strike away, one out away. 3-2. Here it is!
Woo!
Washington champions! First time in franchise history.
Man, good for the Nats and good for Washington, good for all of us. It was a great, great moment. Right? Who wants to start? Emma.
Okay, look, in all honesty, I was asleep when they won.
Oh, but. shame on you.
I did notice the next day when I went to the gym in the morning and I was the only person there. The rest of the city had really enjoyed this. And no, I honestly, you know, this city is in a weird place right now, right? We don't get representation in Congress, even though we pay our taxes. We've got someone in the White House that only 4% of the city voted for. There's a lot going on in the city that's messed up. There's gentrification issues. There's all sorts of stuff. And look, it's nice to all be able to come together and have a win and sort of show the rest of the country that we're not just a swamp. We're not just the National Mall. There's a lot of people here, with a lot of pride for our city.
And they are such a great team and have so much fun and right. So much energy and just. And I saw yesterday, 3% is what the chances were in the beginning of the season that they would make the playoffs. Now they're the world champs.
Well, at 12 under 500, they had a 1.5% shot of getting to the World Series. I mean, it was tremendous. I mean, my family, particularly my daughter, we went to a lot of the games. We didn't go to the World Series games. I wasn't going to take out a second mortgage, but we were just enthralled. I mean, it's so nice to have something in this city that people of every demography, every political background can all pull for all at the same time. It was, and it's nice that in this town, it's not just whether the Redskins are performing well or not. You know, we now have.
You mean the Washington football team?
The Washington football team. Yeah. We now have. we have the champion Mystics. We have
Caps.
The previous Stanley Cup champion Caps, and now we have the Nats. And anyone that says this is not a sports town can stick it where the sun don't shine.
You know what? The thing about it that was so interesting is that neither team won at home.
You'll never see that in your lifetime.
No.
It's really fascinating. So we basically pulled it out in Houston. Mm-hmm. But I must say, I'm not disrespecting one of my colleagues, but Roland Martin came on the air last Monday with his Houston Astros jersey on.
Ooh.
And talked a whole bunch of dookie.
And, watch out with the language there.
No, I intend to go on the air Monday with a Wizards. Not a Wizards, but a Nats cap on. Someone's going to have to lend me one, but I'm going to have to go up because just to stick it back. There were so many people who were so certain that, you know, the Nats couldn't pull it out. So it was really cool to see them pull it out.
All right. Great discussion. Great conversation. A lot to cover. And we always ask you, was there any story during the week that just caught your attention that you thought might be worth sharing with us this morning? Who wants to start?
I will.
Okay.
I want to get ahead of the curve in terms of stories. So Wednesday was a lot of rain in D.C., and today it's 20 degrees lower than it was the day before. We're getting into the Thanksgiving season, and I want to talk a little bit about homelessness. I mean, it's something that we don't talk about, but, you know, there are more than 500,000 people on any given night who don't have any place to live. The number, actually, according to HUD, is about 552,000. And obviously, Congress isn't doing anything about that. When you elect a clown, expect a circus. And so, you know, they're not focusing on this. But I think that we should, Bill. I think that you're going to see, as, you know, you come up on Thanksgiving, you get those headlines. And, you know, let's talk about it early. Talk about the fact that 70% of the homeless are men, that half of them are white. But African-Americans are way overrepresented. We're like 13% of the population and 40% of the homeless. You have more kids who are on the streets and more women. And so this is something that basically deserves attention.
And coming from California, I mean, very serious because it's so beautiful out there. And, you know, Santa Monica, Los Angeles, San Francisco, very, very serious problem, getting more serious every day. And I don't know anybody who has the answer to it.
Well, California.
On that downer.
well, didn't mean to be a downer.
No, I know. I'm just kidding.
But just mentioning real quickly, California, New York, and Florida are the top states for homelessness.
Yeah. Pema?
All right, I'll go in a
different direction.
A different direction. I wanted to say lighter, but it's not. It's just kind of spookier and weirder. Oh. Have you guys heard about this McKinley Mansion? So there's a post story about it this week, and I heard friends talking about it. It's this, I'm using scare quotes here, haunted house in Tennessee. But it's not really a haunted house. Basically, you have to get screened for all the, like, you know, is your heart working? Are you like a... and you're in good physical shape, then you have to sign like a 40-page waiver. And then you go into this and you basically go and agree that they can basically do all sorts of weird shit to you in this house for like 10 hours.
To scare the hell out of you.
It can go up to 10 hours.
What?
And they psychographically profile you. So they like know like, you are afraid of dogs. So like, we're going to like break you until you have like with all these dogs, whatever they do. It's like they profile you and then they tailor it to you. Yeah. And so, no one has ever completed it. No one has ever stuck through to the
end. Do they have to pay to go in there?
There's some sort of weird payment thing. Well, you have to pay. You bring like a bag of dog food for the owner's like dog, and then if you wimp out on certain things inside, they like start charging you money. It's a total crazy thing. There's a huge petition going on, being like, this is literally torture. Like, you have to shut, regulators have to shut this down. And then the guy who runs it. The guy who runs it is like, no, I don't torture people. I just hypnotize them into thinking they're tortured. It's totally bizarre. But, like, you can't enter into a contract to break a law, right? So if you're breaking the law, you're breaking the law. You can't.
What's the name of the place again?
I think it's McKamey. McKamey Mansion.
Right.
Totally crazy. Doesn't seem legal to me. I'm not a lawyer, but seems totally crazy, but apparently some people want to sign a 40-page waiver and then walk into a house where people will
prey on your worst
fears.
Ooh.
Remind me not to go there.
All right, Brad. I'm gonna go back to the Nats.
Oh, okay.
You were
good.
You were watching the post-game celebration. There was an embrace that I think just was everything that you would ever want to see in humanity, in sports, in friendship. It was Anibal Sanchez, who is one of the starting pitchers for the Washington Nationals, and Max Scherzer, who had pitched together in Detroit on a World Series team that I believe was swept. And so the one time they had a chance at a World Series, they both lost. Scherzer obviously eventually came to the Nats. Sanchez was kind of run out of Detroit, having had a couple really tough seasons. He spent a season in Atlanta trying to get his career back, thought about retirement, wound up here this year, started out pretty poorly, lost his first six games, and the two of them embraced on the field afterwards, and Sanchez with tears in his eyes and Scherzer with tears in his eyes, we finally won one.
Great moment.
One of the greatest moments in sports.
That was it was a great moment indeed. So my favorite story is I'm known as I try very hard not to swear on these podcasts, but I'm known as sort of a kind of a potty mouth, and so I was pleased to read this week about a study from Keele University in England, where they talk about the power of profanity, and they did a study and which really showed
You're
that
shitting when me, Bill.
I'm not shitting you. That when you're working out, it really helps if you swear. You get more power and more strength by just cussing your way through your workout. Riding a bicycle, more power, more strength. Even it gives you a rush of adrenaline, they found, and boosts your heart rate and your breathing rate. And even if you like have an injury, you hurt your toe or your finger and you swear the hell out of it, it helps your body combat the pain. So I just want us all to know you can swear up a storm and you'll feel better, you'll live longer. And
this is a clip I'm going to have to send to some people because I too have been accused of the potty mouth
thing.
And I'm like, whatever.
I will say that in the mansion, the haunted mansion, they do charge you every time you swear. So that was one of the things.
This mansion sounds like it's totally non-fun. Just
I know.
All right. Well, thank you all. Thank you, Pamela Lever from Mother Jones, Julianne Malvo from Black Press USA, and Brad Woodhouse from Protect Our Care. Time for my parting shot, which I always hasten to add is not necessarily my views only, not necessarily views of the panelists. But for my parting shot today, I have to tell you that last Sunday, October 27, was a historic day for me. I attended my very first World Series game, Game 5, between the Nats and the Astros. And for the very first time, I stood up and booed a president of the United States, and I'm glad I did both. Now, not everybody agrees it was the right thing to do, of course. Senator Chris Coons said it made him uncomfortable. Joe Scarborough on MSNBC actually called it un-American. I disagree for three reasons. One, Donald Trump didn't belong at that game in the first place. He's not a Nats fan. He's never been to a Nats game, and he wasn't invited to this one. He just announced he was coming. Two, I didn't care whether he was there or not, actually, as long as we didn't have to look at him. And then, while we were standing to cheer members of the military in attendance, they suddenly switched the big screen to show draft dodger Donald Trump. And the entire crowd immediately started booing and then spontaneously started chanting, "Lock him up." And I lustily joined in because, number three, why should we treat Donald Trump with respect when he treats nobody else with respect? This week, for example, calling career diplomats human scum. And of course, he's the one who started the chant, "Lock her up" for Hillary. And today, lock him up for Joe Biden. So don't feel sorry for Donald Trump. He was just getting a taste of his own medicine, which he deserved. But as we just talked about, the best part is that Donald Trump did not jinx the Nats. They went on to win the World Series. Go Nats. And that's it. That's a wrap for today's roundtable. Thanks again to our panelists, Julianne Malvo, Brad Woodhouse, and Pamela Levy. Thanks to all of you for listening. And please, if you haven't already done so, subscribe to the Bill Press Pod. It's easy. Just go to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or TuneIn. Search for the Bill Press Pod and click on subscribe. And the best way to find about every new podcast is by following me on Twitter at Bill Press Pod. Speaking of which, you won't want to miss our next podcast and my interview with former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. He was thinking about running for president in 2020. Could he still jump in? If not, might he run again for governor in 2021? And what's going to happen in the big legislative races in Virginia on November 5? Virginia is turning bluer and bluer. As Virginia goes, so goes the nation. Well, we'll talk about that with Terry McAuliffe in our next podcast. Don't miss it. Thanks again to our panelists. Thanks again to all of you. Stay strong, and we'll see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, They'll be on Auto Trader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.